Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I remember it quite clearly because it was totally unexpected and very cool, but I was in New York City. I was doing the launch of Conspiracy. I met my friend Casey Neistat at Chelsea Piers, and we went for like a 6 or 7 mile run up the side of Manhattan to the USS Enterprise, right? That's the one there. We turned around. It was a great little run, and I could see, I was carrying my phone because I had to meet up with them and I didn't want to get lost and blah, blah, blah. I could see stuff was like going off on my phone, and I was getting a bunch of texts and messages, but I didn't check them. I try not to check the phone in the morning. I try, especially when I am in the midst of a book project or a launch, not to let news in for concern that it could be really bad news that knocks me out of the headspace I want to be, or good news that sucks me into a bad place as far as the ego goes, or just, you know, distracts me. So anyways, I didn't check it. I get back to my hotel and there's like a ton of texts from basically everyone I know in publishing because Conspiracy had been somewhat unexpectedly reviewed in the New York Times, and it was a crazy review, like a crazy good review. It's very unusual to get a review in the Times. It's certainly unusual to get a positive review, and this was just, you know, very unexpected and very amazing. Well, I was reading it, and I noticed the name, and then I realized I'd actually read a book by the author before. His name was William Cohen, and he wrote this fascinating book about the fall of Bear Stearns that I'd read called House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street in 2009. I think I'd seen him on The Daily Show. This is a long time ago, and ended up reading the book, found it fascinating. And then I'd followed his stuff. I would read it every once in a while in Vanity Fair, where he's a staff writer. And so again, just a totally unexpected and very kind review. And actually, if you look at Conspiracy, which is one of the books I'm most proud of, certainly not my most popular book by any measure, but one of the ones I'm most proud of because it was a challenge to write. He's there on the cover. His blurb is there on the cover, which is very nice. And so when I saw that William had a new book out, I wanted to have him on. Power Failure, The Rise and Fall of an American Icon is about the century plus history of GE. It's a lot about Jack Welch and his successors as well. It's a fascinating book about power, about excess, about hubris, about money. And you might not think this would connect to Stoicism, but in fact, he talks about Jack Welch as the imperial CEO. And William and I talk a lot about this idea of imperialization, which Marcus talks about in Meditation. So this ended up being a fascinating philosophical discussion that I think you will really like. William is both a thinker about finance and business, but also had a career in finance and business, so he knows what he's talking about. He's a graduate of Phillips Academy, Duke University, Columbia University, Columbia University Journalism School, and Columbia University Business School. So he's got one hell of a resume, a very smart dude. I think you're really going to like this interview. And as it happens, and you'll see, he's a fan of the Stoics. That's probably how he ended up reviewing Conspiracy. But a nice little full circle moment. And I'm excited to bring you this interview. Check out Power Failure. I think you'll really like his book, House of Cards. His book, Four Friends, Promising Lives Cut Short, has some real Memento Mori themes in it. And he also wrote a book about the Duke lacrosse scandal, which you can check out. It's called The Price of Silence. You can follow him on Twitter at William Cohen. That's C-O-H-A-N. I think you're going to like this. And enjoy. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Well, let's do it. You know, I loved the book. I thought it was fascinating. And as I was reading it, I was sort of thinking of your Bear Stearns book from a few years ago. There's something very Shakespearean about these characters that get so big, so successful, and then life kind of brings them back down to life. Like in the Bear Stearns book, I remember that scene, the guy, he's riding up the elevator in the building that his company owns and built. It's his legacy. And then he's coming back down and it's worth nothing. Or in the case of the new book, like you're Jack Welch, you're a billionaire, you run one of the biggest companies in the world, and somehow you're at your club, not enjoying your retirement, just complaining about the guy who came after you. It's like King Lear or something.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it seems to happen, right? I mean, these guys, and unfortunately, it's mostly guys, right? Seem to live in this rarefied world where they, you know, expect everybody to kowtow to them, everybody to bow to them. I mean, I think, frankly, you know, Ryan, it's too much already. I mean, if you just look literally in the last month at what you know, Elon Musk has done. You know, he and his ego have done to Twitter, and what, you know, our young deity SBF has done to his exchange and the million plus customers and the billions of dollars lost. It's enough already. We have to rethink this kind of billionaire as deity concept that we seem so infatuated with in this country. You know, it didn't start with Jack Welch, obviously, but he was one embodiment of it. And you know, he probably was worthy to some extent of it. But I mean, now it's just gotten completely over the deep end.
You know, you rendered this scene really beautifully at the beginning. You know, you meet with him and his first words out of his mouth are, you know, I fucked up. And he's just ranting about the guy that came after him. The only thing that struck me as kind of discordant about the note was like, when you guys left the club, you got in a Jeep Cherokee. And that didn't... It struck me as if you're writing a screenplay of that scene, that's not the car you would have him be in.
Well, as I said, I was expecting the other car, his Mercedes convertible. In fact, I was a little disappointed that it wasn't a Mercedes. It wasn't his Mercedes convertible. It was this, you know, standard issue Jeep Cherokee, you know, which is, you know, even though he's Catholic, it's sort of New England waspy, you know, essence, you know, and I'm Jewish, he's Catholic, but we're probably both two of the waspiest Jews or Catholics anybody knew, you know, both New England upbringing, Massachusetts. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking, well, it'd be much more appropriate for him to be driving what he usually drove around the island, which is his Mercedes convertible. But, you know, there it was, his Jeep Cherokee. And, you know, then I thought, well, now I'm going to die because he's driving literally in the middle of the street. But at least, you know, when I go out, my obit might say that Jack Welch was driving the car that I died in. So that was okay.
He's not driving responsibly, and there's the ping of the seatbelt indicator not being on. I don't know, both those things kind of felt to me to be a little bit indicative or maybe symbolic about how someone like that, what their relationship is to risk.
Yeah, I mean, I even asked him, as I said, to put his seatbelt on, if only to get the beeping to stop, and he had no interest in that. And then, by the way, he doesn't strike me as, he had this sort of impish kind of quality about him, so it didn't seem like he was doing it to be nefarious or, you know, an asshole. He was just like, okay, I'm doing what I want to do, which is I don't want to wear my seatbelt, and I want to drive down the middle of the road, and I'm going to. And both of those things, you know, struck me as odd based on who I thought he was in our, you know, 2-hour-long conversation that we had just ended. I guess maybe it is consistent with the first thing out of his mouth is I fucked up in the selection of my successor. Maybe they're all just one of, you know, part of a piece that I should have anticipated. But, you know, if you're a writer, you're a observer of human nature. And that's one of the things I love about your books is, you know, this is like for me as an observer of human nature and someone who's going to write this scene up, because it was obvious that I would. I mean, this is just more delicious than I could possibly have anticipated.
It's just, it's sort of strange because on the one hand, they're very ordinary people. And then everything about them kind of has this surreal, as you said, like a refined quality. And you can't tell if it's like the Fitzgerald thing where the very rich are different than you and I, or if there's some part of their mentality one internalizes or one is born with that allows them to make these sort of billion or trillion dollar decisions that affect millions of people. And they just kind of do it for the same reasons as you saw in the car. Like, I wanted to drive down the middle of the road, or my gut was telling me I needed to get out of this business or that business. Like, it's almost a general quality. I don't know what you want to call it, but the ability to make decisions for which other people's asses are put on the line is not a trait that I think you naturally have or most people have.
Well, and certainly Jack Welch was not born anything like that. I mean, he was an only child. His father was essentially a train conductor, you know, on the train line north of Boston to the North Shore of Massachusetts that I used to ride on as a kid. And, you know, he grew up right near there and he like caddied at the Jewish club. You know, his mother was a homemaker and, you know, told, you know, just doted on him. I think that probably this started to be his affect in and around the time he, you know, was the king of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, when he was head of GE Plastics and making it, you know, very successful business and starting to climb the GE ladder. I'm sure, you know, at that point, you know, he literally had his own fiefdom inside of GE. Maybe he was the king of nothing. You know, he's like the king of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, but, you know, he had his own private jet. His office was in like some, you know, Hilton in downtown Pittsfield. And, you know, he would go out with the boys and carouse around and never wanted to go to headquarters in Fairfield until he finally realized that if he didn't go to Fairfield, he was never going to have a chance to become CEO. And he wanted that more than he wanted to be the king of nothing. So he wanted to be the king of everything. And I think at that point, you know, he suddenly got very enamored, as people does. I mean, it's not really do. It's not really that hard to get enamored of people fawning all over you and sort of the imperial CEO. I mean, you know, that's not really a hard thing to, you know, say to yourself, my God, can I get used to this? And so I think he got quite enamored of it and used to it. And when you're the CEO of GE, I mean, people fawn all over you. I mean, it's an imperial, it's like an imperial presidency. You know, the private jets, multiple private jets, and the you know, the great surroundings, and, you know, you get to meet with whoever you want, whenever you want to. And people are like falling over themselves to have access to you. I mean, so, you know, it's no surprise that this only child who was born into severe modesty, relative, I mean, not poverty, but, you know, certainly lower middle class, you know, got used to the trappings of great wealth and loved people fawning all over him.
The imperial CEO is kind of an interesting way to put it there, because it does seem to be this class of people or small group of people who have a ton of power. You know, at least the imperial president, as they call it, is sort of obligated to the voters, or there's some public component of what they do, or at least the pretense of it. But to a generation of CEOs, it feels like this was this school of thought they developed where it's all about maximizing shareholder value, but without maybe the constraints of the previous generations, the social norms, or the governors on what they could or wouldn't do.
Yeah, and if you are the CEO who's responsible, you know, already, you know, even in 1981 when Jack took over GE, you know, GE had by that point been around for, you know, 85 years. Already highly regarded and highly influential, the creator of the Business Roundtable in Washington. But when you're the CEO of a company that, when you take it over, is worth $12 billion, and then under your leadership and tutelage, et cetera, it goes to become worth $650 billion and the most valuable company in the world and the most respected company in the world, and you're the CEO of the century, then you can imagine what happens to you then. This was, you know, this is just an, I mean, he was, you know, truly invincible. And GE was the combination of, you know, Apple, Google, Microsoft, sort of all rolled up into one. Jack was probably even more revered than Steve Jobs was when he was the leader. Steve Jobs has become more revered, you know, in his departure, even though we should really be revering, you know, Tim Cook, who's taken Apple from a value of $300 billion to $2.5 trillion. He's probably created more shareholder value than any other single person in the history of the world. But you know, you're right. A lot of the foibles that Jack Welch, you know, did in his life, you know, he would have probably have been canceled as a CEO, you know, these days, despite that incredible performance, you know, for shareholders.
It's weird to think how old GE is as a company. I mean, what do you think Edison would have thought of his legacy, the people who inherited what he had made? Because it's interesting, he was this creator, he was this brilliant inventor, but he was also a killer. I mean, like, in the sense of he's a shark. Like, he knew how to make money. He knew what would make money. He would defend what he did. But he was also, I think, by definition, not one of these educated financial types. I mean, he was a real engineer, not a financial engineer. He was a doer, not a manager.
Well, and one of the things that I learned in the researching and the writing of this book is that there's this huge myth around Thomas Edison and GE. He actually had much less to do with GE's creation than the myth makers at GE would like you to believe. Like, you know, on the one day that GE was cooperating with me for in the writing of this book, the one day, literally one day, they let me go up to this town outside of Albany where they had their research center. And you go into this research center, a very imposing building in beautiful, you know, Niskayuna, New York. And like the whole lobby is all about Thomas Edison and his role in creating GE. And there's his desk and there's the stock ticker he created and there are his patents and everything and his famous quotations, et cetera. But what I learned in researching this book is actually Thomas Edison did not want to create this company. He had created something called Edison General Electric, which was, you know, a company that, you know, made electric power generation. And then it, you know, it had to be connected to grids, which is something else that his company did. But by the time this all came about, which was in 1892, he was no longer the CEO of the company. A guy named Henry Villard had become the CEO, and Henry Villard had been a New York banker and then a big railroad tycoon, and he had become affiliated with J.P. Morgan. And J.P. Morgan, the man, was the money behind Edison General Electric, along with Henry Villard, and Henry Villard was the CEO. And Edison was basically just pushed out as a shareholder, a minor shareholder of this company. And then Henry Villard and J.P. Morgan wanted to merge the company into a company that had been created, that had been bought by a guy named Charles Coffin, who was in the shoe business in Lynn, Massachusetts, and wanted to get into something sexier like generating electric power. So he and his venture capitalists in Boston decided to buy Edison General Electric to create General Electric. Thomas Edison was completely against it. Like, he tried to stop it repeatedly and could not, because the money men had to have their way, just like they do today. And they did the merger anyway. And soon enough, Thomas Edison was out, OUT gone, sold his stock and like moved to New Jersey to create like a limestone mining company or something.
He got into concrete or something like that. He had a weird detour.
Yeah, concrete, total detour. Yeah, that did not work out particularly well. Not many of his things worked out particularly well commercially for him. I mean, now we take all of them for granted, but, you know, I don't know that he benefited tremendously. I don't think he was a rich guy or anything, not like his money men who did very well. But he didn't want this merger, and this first CEO of the company was Charles Coffin, not Thomas Edison. But, you know, it's not as sexy a story to have, you know, the shoe manufacturer Charles Coffin be the founder of GE when it could be Thomas Edison. So, voila, instant mythology. We have Thomas Edison as our founder. Not true, though.
But that does make sense then with where it ended up, because it was always a company more focused on financial engineering than actual engineering. And it's enormous growth in valuation. It's not from the stuff. It's from how that stuff is valued and packaged and repackaged. It's the people who managed to take the widget and turn it into sort of make it something bigger than that, you know, build the PowerPoint presentation, the products around it. That seems to be what made GE become what it became.
Yeah, and even so, it was founded in 1892, and then in 1893, as I'm sure you will remember, there was a major financial crisis, and GE had, it was a public company from the outset, and had $10 million of debt, which proved to be too much debt in 1893, because their revenue fell off a cliff in the second half of the year, and their debt traded down at a discount. And what saved the company from bankruptcy was the decision to buy that debt back at a discount. So talk about financial engineering right from the get-go with J.P. Morgan, the man who was up at his house, you know, whatever, summering in Maine, finally giving the final okay to do that. And then Charles Coffin doing that and then deciding from then on out he was going to have like a fortress balance sheet like J.P. Like, you know, Jamie Dimon talks about at J.P. Morgan, or, you know, whether that's true or not remains, you know, is debatable. But, you know, that was the mentality. And, you know, the irony of that, of course, is that it was, you know, the balance sheet was not fortress. And in 2008, that became a huge problem for GE. They had way too much debt and they were reliant on the short-term financing markets. So they saved themselves from ignominy, you know, in 1893, but, you know, it still ended up there in 2008.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. You know, it is interesting. It's like at this unimaginable level, hundreds of millions, billions, trillions of dollars, these enormous companies, all these employees, to go to the Shakespearean level of it, it comes down to like, I'm picking my successor. Why am I doing it? Am I judging them properly? Am I blinded by this trait or that trait in them, in myself? And then the successor comes in and they're successful for this reason or not this reason. And we talked about Elon Musk earlier. It's like one of the largest private transactions in history. And then it's clear that it's really this guy who's just like a guy, like one of your friends who's addicted to using the social media platform. He's running the largest social network in the world, one of the largest social networks in the world, basically on his personal whim. It's totally unimaginable, but also, and unrelatable, but also so normal. It's like buying a restaurant down the street because you really like it and then running it to the ground because you totally misunderstand how it works. You know, it's fascinating and terrifying, the sort of the will, the power, the interdependence of all things, how much life, like current events, pivots on individuals and their personality flaws and virtues and vices.
I mean the Musk Twitter story is totally, you know, singular. I mean, it's really, you could not dream it up, right? I mean, it would be only possible to happen at all in sort of a world where there are these incredibly wealthy people who we, of course, lionize. And then there's this pandemic that makes them even richer. Like I think at the beginning of the pandemic, Musk's net worth was like $30 billion. And then, you know, quote unquote, at the end of the pandemic, it was like $250 billion. And if it was $30 billion, there's no way he would spend $44 billion buying Twitter. So the only reason he could like have the folly of thinking he could actually buy Twitter for $44 billion was because he'd had the folly of seeing his net worth going from $30 billion to $250 billion, which is absurd.
Yeah, like his net worth went to this enormous level on paper, but it's not really real. And in one sense, it's all this financial engineering. Yeah, real assets, real estate, et cetera. He had an inflated asset.
Yeah, and I'm sure he knew on some, I mean, this it's true, I'm sure he knew on some level that it was funny money because so much of his net worth was tied up in Tesla, which was, you know, absurdly valued at one point worth more than $1 trillion. And so, you know, what people do often when their net worth is inflated by some sort of crazy valuation metric is that they try to, you know, take some risk off the table by turning it into something else, which might hold its value, like cash or real assets, or you know, U.S. treasuries, or you know, as you say, real estate. And he decided to buy Twitter, which is like theater of the absurd, and then overpay for it. It's a wasting asset, and he's the one wasting it. I mean, it wasn't so great to begin with, but now he's totally wasting it. I don't think. As you know, there's never been, as you alluded to at the beginning, a buyout where the equity investor puts in, you know, $31 billion of equity, of which 24 of it comes from him personally. Okay, I don't think there's ever a single individual has ever put $24 billion into a single deal before. Okay, that's Elon Musk. Then he corrals 18 of his buddies to put in another $7 billion. So that's the 31. Then he borrows $13 billion from a group of banks. That's the 44. And then the day this deal closes, that equity is essentially wiped out and the debt is worth half of $13 billion. I mean, you can't even imagine any of this. I mean, and then in the middle of all that, before he closes, he wants to get out of the deal because he's got buyer's remorse, and he comes up with all these bullshit reasons to do it and takes everybody to court in Delaware, and then, you know, decides, well, you know, I'm going to lose that, so I better close it. I mean, you couldn't even make this up if you wanted to. And the thing that's incredible to me is literally that despite all of that equity in the deal, the company is still hugely overleveraged, and he could very well go into bankruptcy, as he himself said, and he could just lose control of it as soon as April when he has to make his first interest payment.
No, it's weird because, as we said, like it's incomprehensible and unreal, and yet it's somehow kind of exactly what you expect would happen if someone was stretched so thin running all these different companies at the same time. And then they're put in charge of one enormous unwieldy thing that they actually weren't super familiar with outside of their own use. Like they didn't do due diligence. They don't have a transition team. It's very human and Shakespearean. It's the Stoics say character is fate. If you put a person with unmanageable manic energy with a cult of personality around them, how it's gone is basically about as bad as I think you'd predict it would go.
I mean, if you were writing a novel, you might write it this way.
Yeah, right.
But would you ever expect to see it in real life, IRL, actually happening?
No. It's madness, total madness. You know, to be charitable, though, I was talking to a person who sort of put a significant amount of money in the fund that was purchasing it. They were saying that they were arguing that it's like not unlike sort of 80s corporate rating. You have these inflated, complacent, unwieldy big companies. You buy them, you get rid of the stuff that's not profitable. You renegotiate certain deals. You cut off, you know, certain expenses or perks. You chop the asset up. You know, he was basically saying like he believed it was sort of a corporate takeover akin to the ones we saw in the 80s. I don't know if that's actually right, but I thought it was at least. I was trying to think of like what is a smart take on it that's not my take. And in theory, I buy it as a potential argument, but just watching how it's actually unfolded, it seems way too contradictory and erratic and inefficient to possibly be not even adhering to that thesis, for that thesis to be a big part of the motivation.
I mean, I'm laughing because you always hear somebody who's involved in a leveraged buyout talking about there's bloat at the company and we can streamline it and make it more efficient and increase margins and pay down the debt and make a fortune for ourselves. That is like textbook. Of course they say that. Are you really telling me that okay, the bloat was more than half the workforce? Are you telling me that these more than half the workforce had no role, no substantive role at this company? And meanwhile, in addition to that, you're pissing off advertisers. Have you looked at Twitter lately? Do you see what they're advertising? They're advertising like vegetable peelers. I mean, I feel like, Ron Popeil has taken over Twitter. I mean, it's truly embarrassing now. And so, just stepping back from it, I don't care how they make their money or anything. I don't even care if this whole thing disappears. The world will not mourn the loss of Twitter. But as a story, as a journalistic, observer to this, this is just like incredible. I mean, he is literally, he's driving, he's doing everything wrong, right? Operationally. He did everything wrong financially. He's supposed to be the smartest guy in the world, supposedly the richest guy in the world. He is literally potentially going to lose in 6 months' time $44 billion and the control of this company.
Is that just what happens? Eventually the tide goes out, or eventually the person overreaches? Is that just how it goes? Or did something happen? Did something break in his brain? It's endlessly fascinating to me from an ego perspective. How does a person who is so talented and skilled and seemingly disciplined, how did this happen? Or was it an emperor has no clothes situation? Now you see it from another angle and you realize it was never what you thought it was.
Well, I mean, again, it's part of this problem we have in this country of lionizing these people so that they think that their, shit doesn't stink. He didn't create Tesla. He infused Tesla with capital at a time when the company was sort of on its knees, and money that he had made from PayPal. I mean, he may have financed SpaceX, but I mean, obviously he's not running SpaceX. No, it doesn't have to be this way. I mean, look at Tim Cook, right? I mean, Tim Cook, who basically nobody really knows. I mean, I've never met him or talked to him. I mean, we're not obsessed about Tim Cook every day. All he's done, he doesn't make a nuisance of himself or draw attention to himself. All we know about Tim Cook is that he's taken over Apple when this, heroic, iconic CEO, Steve Jobs, who was fired and then comes back and makes it this incredible company with all these interesting products, and it's worth $300 billion. And then he's taken it, to $2.5 trillion in value. So that's another way to go. Right. Or you could go the Elon Musk way or the SBF way or the Bob Chapek, Bob Iger way. I mean, you don't have to be a narcissistic, egotistical jerk, but why in the world do we lionize these people and envy and look up to these people who are these narcissistic jerks. And it's not just in business. It's obviously, you know, we saw it with Donald Trump too. I mean, why, oh, why, oh, why would Americans elect this guy who's got no basis for anything? He's not a successful businessman. He's not a successful TV personality. He's a pathetic politician. He's so, the opposite of inspiring. And he's not even gone yet. Now we have to worry about him coming back. What is going on here?
It is interesting. There is a passage in Meditations where Marcus Aurelius is writing to himself. He goes, you have to worry. You have to be careful and guard yourself against being imperialized. He says, beware of imperialization. Don't be Caesarified, dyed in purple. Like, when you're talking about the imperial CEO, he says, you have to be careful not to let that position change who you are. The emperor's cloak was purple. And so he's saying, you can't be stained purple by the job. And you have to remember, like, he's saying that the purple in the cape comes from dried shellfish blood. He was talking about how they get the color purple back then. He was trying to remind himself, I'm not that special. I'm not that important. There's this statue, which is right outside Budapest, that I think he would have liked. It's a statue of the emperor, and it has Marcus's head on it. But they notice the head is removable. Like, the emperor is worshipped, but instead of putting this whole statue together for each new emperor, because at one point there's one year where they have five of them, they just get tired. And so they're like, look, let's just put on a new head. We'll keep the body. Like, you can only be in this space for so long before something happens to you. And, you know, you can only be exposed to so much radiation to be exposed to radiation for so long. It does seem that you can only have the imperial CEO, like, live in that rarefied air, have that power for so long before something happens to you. Like, I don't know, is the clock ticking on Tim Cook? He could blow up tomorrow, then we'd see the whole story differently. But it does seem like the longer you're in it, the more publicity you seek out. I don't know, like, Tim Cook doesn't seem to be cultivating being in the headlines, being controversial, being seen places. And maybe that's insulating him a little bit. Like, maybe if you do seek out those things, as Musk invariably did, it accelerates that clock, or it exaggerates the stress or gravity that's operating on you.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, I mean, in the media, you know, we love to build somebody up and then we love to tear them down, you know, and you know, constantly. And that transcends business, politics, Hollywood, you know, whatever it is. That's that arc of that narrative is something so American that we love to do that. And we love nothing better than to build them up and put SBF on the cover of Fortune and Forbes and compare him to Warren Buffett. Right. The next Warren Buffett, you know, just 60 years younger. And then, you know, a month later, you know, now he's what now what prison is he going to? Is he going to Butner or Lumpick, or where is he off to? So, you know, if we didn't build these people up so much, then we wouldn't have to, you know, tear them down. I mean, again, I think I point again, you know, to Tim Cook, who, you know, sort of avoids the limelight, even though he's certainly entitled to it. I mean, he's CEO of the biggest, you know, richest company, most valuable company on the planet. You know, but he is clever enough to not make it about him, to make it about the company. But, you know, these other people are not so clever. They can't resist the limelight. And, you know, the media is very, you know, compelling. You know, it's very tantalizing. It's very seductive. Is you know, as you probably know too, as any author with a book, any writer with a book, you know, it's very hard to say no. I mean, you know, part of you wants, you know, a double segment on 60 Minutes so that you can sell books. And part of you knows that you should be repulsed by that that desire. And then you get mad when you don't get it. And then you don't get mad when you're angry when you don't get, you know, or someone else gets it. I remember, you know, when I was a banker on Wall Street, and, you know, we were getting, you know, wildly overpaid. And then, you know, you'd hear that somebody else got, you know, $250,000 more in a bonus than you did. And of course, they did nothing to deserve it, but just were better at sucking up or whatever it was. And then you'd be infuriated for the next 6 months. And, you know, instead of stepping back and saying, Jesus, I'm getting so much more than I could have ever hoped or dreamed of getting paid for taking no risk at all. You know, so it's a very, it's just so distressing. The whole cycle just annoys me just tremendously. The whole cycle, that narrative arc of building them up, tearing them down, and then, you know, the schadenfreude of enjoying sort of both sides of that equation.
I was trying to tell this friend who'd invested the money in the deal. I was like, I got to tell you, you know, the American Apparel spiral, I saw it and I see a lot of similarities here. Like I saw Charney go that way.
Yes, you did.
And what's so interesting about it is changing how I see things, which I remember, like in these various spirals, there's this human side of it. Like how did he get George Soros to give him millions of dollars or Ron Burkle to give him millions of dollars? These were some of the smartest people in the world. Or so they say. And like Dove was clearly nuts. And even if he's not nuts, you know, probably it's going to be more trouble than it's worth. And yet people kept going back to it. And when I see the Musk thing, I also think of the Trump thing and like people who should telling themselves they're going to be the adult in the room, but it never works out that way. They're like, you know, even though it went terribly for these other people who went and did this deal, it's going to be different for me. Those are the magic words. Like, it's different this time. It's different for me.
It's the bad boyfriend scenario. Like, you know, my wife always tells me about the bad boyfriend. Oh, well, I'll, you know, I'm attracted to the bad boyfriend because he's so much fun and, you know, sexy or whatever. And he won't treat me badly, you know, even though he's treated everybody else badly. But, you know, what does he do? You know, why do scorpions sting? That's what scorpions do, you know, and it's no different with these assholes. And I look at, I mean, just look at the words around what these supposedly brilliant investors said when they were investing, you know, in FTX, the Sequoia crowd just couldn't get enough of it fast enough, even though, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried was playing a video game on a Zoom during their interview. I mean, didn't get dressed up, didn't even show up in person, you know, was playing a video game and they still couldn't throw money at him fast enough. Or look at, you know, this one really is the total head scratcher for me. And I just love it because I think Mark Andreessen gets angrier and angrier, as I pointed out, you know, to invest $350 million in Adam Neumann's new stupid company after WeWork, the WeWork debacle, is extraordinary. If I were, and I never will be, and thank God for it, if I were a limited partner in Andreessen Horowitz, or as they cheekily call themselves, A16Z, I would be ripshit if he had invested my money in a new Adam Neumann project. And yet, $350 million? Sure. Largest investment that Andreessen Horowitz has ever made was in Adam Neumann's new company after the WeWork debacle.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand-name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. So what is that? Because I remember you and I connected over Peter Thiel. You wrote a review of Conspiracy at the Times, which is a real treat for me. But I remember I was sitting in at Peter Thiel's office, and it was like the day after he made his first Trump donation, and he's coming off the Gawker thing. It was this huge coup. People still thought really highly of him. He was this genius. He was known for being a picker of talent, smart people, got things done. And he makes this kind of counterintuitive Trump bet, which paid off in that, you know, Trump is elected, but obviously it ends in catastrophe, as Thiel now admits was very likely. But I remember listening to his logic, and it wasn't like, well, I know all the reasons I shouldn't, blah, blah, blah. It was kind of this like casual, offhanded thing, like multiple people think X, so I'm going to think the opposite of X, like this instinctive hunting program. And so I'm just going to do that again. You go to Mark Andreessen, who puts $350 million into a dude who just catastrophically blew up. That is crazy. Is it that they fool? Is it that they're so smart they convince themselves to do something that is obviously not smart?
Well, you know, and I'm sure somebody like Mark Andreessen thinks that, you know, he has to be the smartest guy always in every room all the time. And so if he is investing $350 million in Adam Neumann's new venture, and it's the biggest investment Andreessen Horowitz has ever made in its history, then therefore it's prima facie evidence of brilliance. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think that's a little different than maybe what Peter Thiel did with Trump, or, you know, another version of that is what Steve Mnuchin, who became the Treasury Secretary, did with Trump, and he's explained this to me. It was like, you know, a free option was on the ground and I picked it up. Everybody loves a free option. It's like way out of the money option. So it's not going to cost me a lot of money. It's like what hedge fund guys try to do all the time. It's like a way out of the money option, asymmetrical risk that's very cheap to own. And then if it pays off, like with, in the financial crisis, the people who bet that the mortgage market would fall, John Paulson, you know, it was very cheap to buy the credit default swaps that enabled that to happen, or Bill Ackman, when he bet that at the start of the pandemic that the debt markets would, the yields would spike up when the economy shut down, and then the Fed would come along and rescue the financial markets yet again. And so that making that bet was very inexpensive because everybody thought he was crazy. John Paulson making his out of the money bet on the mortgage market, everybody thought he was crazy. And so maybe, you know, and of course Warren Buffett famously, you know, makes bets when everybody else is running for the hills, and he's made, you know, a fortune and is revered the world over. So there are people who fancy themselves as Warren Buffett, not fake Warren Buffetts like Sam Bankman-Fried, but who, you know, who really think of themselves as good investors, who are always looking for sort of these free options that are lying on the ground that they can just pick up. You know, you never hear about it if it doesn't work out. So, I mean, probably the preponderance of the time these things don't work out, but when they do pay off, and they pay off big time, like Bill Ackman, you know, in that trade in 3 weeks, he turned $27 million into $3.5 billion. That's like the greatest trade on an IRR basis of all time. And I'm still sort of marvel at that. Think about that. You know, it's incredible. But, you know, who has $27 million lying around that they can, you know, conceive of this trade and then put it up? Obviously, it's part their money, part other people's money. You know, with Andreessen Horowitz, what is that? That's like, you know, their limited partner's money. That's why I'd say, you know, I'd be really pissed if I were a limited partner that he's doing this. But, you know, he has to prove on a daily basis how freaking smart he is. And, you know, what the SBF situation or the investing in the equity of Twitter going private shows you is that these guys are not that smart. I mean, unless you're like, you know, Larry Ellison, you have $70 billion and you don't mind blowing $1 billion on a, you know, crazy bet on Elon Musk. I mean, my favorite is just quickly one more second on this is, Prince Al Walid in Saudi Arabia. You know, I wrote a profile of him in Vanity Fair, maybe 10 years ago, and it was quite exciting for a lot of reasons, but whatever. Then he found himself in the Ritz-Carlton with MBS, put him there for whatever, 6 months. So he's not quite the same guy he was. But he was an early investor in Twitter, right? When it went public, and when it was private, then it went public. And I think he invested $300 million. And at $54.20 a share, his original investment was basically worth $1.9 billion. He could have taken that out in cash at the end of October. Instead, he agreed to roll it over into the equity of the new Twitter, the private Twitter. And now it's probably a zero, except for the option value that somehow Elon Musk is some sort of genius and is going to actually do something with Twitter that looks like he's not going to do. So Prince Al Walid had a $1.6 billion profit, and he's now a zero a month later.
Yeah, the perilous part of the victory, the pyrrhic nature of it is that when you're right, like you pick up the free option, you know, $1 million on Trump's campaign after the Access Hollywood tape, then he becomes president. You just bought it very cheap, but what you just bought Access very cheap. But what you also bought, not intentionally, was the hubris or the default view that you actually did the right thing in that moment. In actuality, you made this sort of pretty reprehensible bet on a totally unpredictable person who has no business being president. And now that shapes how you see yourself and enabling you to do pretty much whatever you want. You walk through these, you walk, think thoughtlessly into these future moments. The seeds are sown when you picked up this supposedly free option. It was very expensive.
I mean, like, look at Steve Mnuchin, right? I mean, he makes a bet on Trump. Nobody else, everybody thinks he's crazy on Wall Street. He becomes his like co-finance chairman. Trump wins. He becomes Treasury Secretary. Oh my God, I'm Treasury Secretary. I'm like this guy who got flushed out of Goldman Sachs, who made a lot of bad bets in Hollywood, wasn't that great a junk bond investor at a hedge fund. You know, now I'm Treasury Secretary and I'm there for all 4 years. And, you know, I've completely, I mean, my own family is mad at me, my father, my brother, you know, I didn't do anything to mitigate Trump's behavior. I never stood up to him. All I did was, you know, help facilitate getting the corporate tax rate going from 35 to 21. And then I come out of that and I, you know, have my new private equity firm where I've gotten whatever, $1 billion or $2 billion, just like Jared Kushner from the Saudis. That's who I am now.
Yeah, it shows, again, I keep using this word, how Shakespearean it is about it. You know, you make these bargains. You know, Seneca's tutor, Ring Nero, he's the powerful rich guy in the Roman Empire. As a result, he makes these big loans to the colony of Britain. But by the time he realizes, hey, this guy is insane, I need to get out. And Nero says, hey, that's not how it works. You know, it's easy to get in, easy to pick up the free option, but then you can't. I was just writing something about this. There's this speech about Cato, and he's talking about people who are dealing with Caesar. And he says, you put this guy on your shoulders, and there's going to come a time when you can't keep carrying him, but also you don't have the strength to put him down. The point is you get stuck. You can't get out. And that seems to be where Musk is with Twitter, or, you know, people are with Trump. You make these deals, you think you're getting the better of it, but actually, you know, you're selling the most expensive thing that there is.
Your reputation. It takes a lifetime to build a reputation and a nanosecond to lose it, is, I think, Will Rogers said. Or, you know, the truth is, you know, can't get out of bed before a lie gets around the world. I don't know how these people live with themselves. I never could figure out, you know, Ryan, you know, Donald Trump was a product of New York City, you know, first Queens, then Manhattan. New York City is like the media capital of the country, right? So, I mean, and people have written lots of stories about Donald Trump and what a freaking buffoon he was. I'd written two stories about him, one in Vanity Fair, one in The Atlantic, about what a total buffoon he was. And yet, somehow, we could not convey beyond the Hudson how pathetic and dangerous this guy was. You know, he did lose the popular vote, obviously, but that's not the way we... But not only by a little, but we, that's, of course, that's irrelevant because that's not the way we elect our presidents, you know, and he exploited whatever hatred or divisions that we have in this country to his own political benefit. And that was bad enough. And then he governed like a totally cynically for 4 years and is still, you know, pushing his bullshit. And people are still not had enough of him. I don't understand. I mean, I may be in my, I don't understand my country anymore. I understand half of the country, but not the other half.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought the interesting quote in your book, to go back to GE, maybe it's hopefully kind of a last defense against the sort of tragic things we're talking about. It, you have those words from Welch's predecessor. He sort of mumbled off before he dies. He says, leadership requires ethics, morals, and values. And I think you've seen that people were talking about a lot of ambition, a lot of skill, sort of financial acumen, brilliance. They're great on all these things, but eventually where they get into trouble or overcommit or get in these scandals is when they, where they lack in the ethics, morals, and values. Could a strong set of values and morals, like, couldn't that be a last line of defense against some of this stuff? Or maybe it's naive. Maybe no amount of morals can stand the temptation of potentially billions of dollars or access or power, or whatever. I don't know.
Well, I think to some extent our culture has changed, you know, and I've thought about this a lot. And I basically my whole lifetime has been a series of weird disappointments. You know, certainly politically, right? I mean, I was born in 1960, so I mean, I was barely conscious, but I mean, I sort of trace it back to November 22nd, 1963. I mean, I think the Kennedy assassination sort of set the tone for politically for what happened in my whole lifetime. I mean, it just deteriorated from there, whether it was, you know, Vietnam and getting deeper in there and lying about what we were doing there and secret bombing and protests to Watergate to somebody like, Gerald Ford pardoning Nixon and then Jimmy Carter, you know, being moral and ethical and getting, you know, completely driven from office. Right. And then, you know, to end up with Trump, I mean, it's just, this is this sort of the whole arc of my lifetime has been sort of one, you know, political disappointment after another. And to the point now where, you know, we can have, you know, Mitch McConnell bogarting a Supreme Court appointment for a year and then like thinking nothing of it, just like, that's fine. That's what we're here to do, you know, and then remaking the Supreme Court, you know, in this, you know, right wing conservative basis that is repealing our rights. It's just beyond what I can, you know, I guess maybe as a good Massachusetts liberal, you know, I can get my mind around. It is so mind blowing on a continuous basis. And social media just compounds it all. I mean, it's like, I don't even know who I am or where, you know, I fit in anymore. And maybe that's okay because I'm just like a old white guy and maybe I don't fit in anymore. But, you know, it's not certainly not the country that I thought I was grow up in or that I was, you know, going to inherit or be part of as an adult.
Yeah. I mean, I think about your story, you know, can people withstand the limitation of money, but, you know, to do the right thing, but whatever. I mean, reading about your history, you're making a fortune in leveraged buyouts in the 80s. if you kept going in finance, I imagine your net worth would be a little higher now as a writer. As wonderful as your books are, as prestigious as the outlets are you've written for, I mean, maybe we end on this hopeful note, which is, like, talk to me about that multi-million dollar decision, what it meant to you. Like, I know if I'm a young person, like, whether I should go work at Twitter right now or crypto or do something else, like, what should I be thinking about?
Well, sometimes decisions get forced upon you. You know, when I graduated from business school and then started at G Capital financing leverage buyouts, the last thing I ever expected was that I would become, you know, a writer, you know, 18 years later, go back to writing. So if I hadn't been fired by my assholic colleagues at JP Morgan Chase in 2004, who fired me because I wasn't in the room where they were making the decisions to fire people, I never would have gone back to being a writer. I would have kept on being a banker. And you're right, my bank account would be larger. My impact, I mean, I don't know that I have any impact on the world, but I mean, my control over my life would be very different. I have, you know, basically total control over what I do in my life, and that's very satisfying. You know, writing these books, as you know, Ryan, is very hard, but it's also very satisfying. And, you know, I'd much rather be known as a best-selling author than a former, you know, than an investment banker. So, you know, all that is very, very satisfying, but also extremely serendipitous because, you know, if a little cabal hadn't formed at JP Morgan Chase to get rid of me, which was easy enough for them to do, it was either them or me, then this would never have happened. So, you know, when I see these people who obviously are very sheepish around me now because they know what they did, you know, I thank them. You know, I thank them for firing me and allowing me to, you know, be forced into a totally different life and using a different skill set and different part of my brain. I mean, I'm glad I did that for 17 years. Believe me, it's given me great expertise to write, you know, do the writing I do, and to not, you know, endure the bullshit that usually comes out of the mouths of people on Wall Street when they're talking to journalists and writers. So, you know, I know what I'm talking about, and I think it gives me more gravitas in what I'm writing and more expertise. And so that is just sort of like a fabulous serendipitous thing, but I never would have thought it was even remotely possible, you know, when in January 2004, I got called in and was, you know, sent on my way.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird to think about, but one of the things that's been helpful to me is, like, when I sort of meet these extremely wealthy people, is that the first thing they want to do is talk about writing. Is that they'd almost as a rule rather be doing anything other than the thing they actually do that makes a lot of money. And they all love books. They all fancy they could do it. And they want some way to do it without having given up what they've done. Like, I don't know if you watched Yellowstone, but the first episode, he says, like, remember, if somebody had all the money in the world, this is what they buy, like the thing they have, right? And you meet successful people and—
all they want to do is write books.
Yeah, they want to be a writer. They want to have their kid not hate them or any number of things. And that's not what their life is. And they could have had it much more cheaply than they think, of course. That would mean giving up the rare thing we're talking about, though, like the jet, the power, the 20-hour work week.
Yeah, and some of them reach out to me and ask me if I will ghostwrite their books, and you know, that's not a good combination of skills. You know, I'm not a ghostwriter. You know, I need to write things the way I discover them to be and research them to be. I don't want to write things the way somebody wishes they were. You know. And so I'm not a good match for that, but I do get asked, you know, that's not good. But, you know, it's funny how they all want to put down their lessons learned or their memoirs or, you know, here's the wisdom that I can impart to you. And if they would just let somebody tell their story the way it really happened, as opposed to, you know, the hagiographic way they'd like it to be, it would be a much better story and they'd have much better impact. But you can't possibly tell them that's the way they should go. They won't listen to you.
Yeah, that's true. Ghostwriting is tricky. I've done a fair amount of it. I always told myself that one of the reasons you do it is it's one of the few situations where it's not that I don't care how the books do, but if I'm going to write about an obscure school of ancient philosophy, it helps not necessarily to have to depend on that to make the bills.
Well, you've got your bookstore.
It's not a huge money-making venture, as you can imagine.
Mm. Yes, I bet. Well, just selling your books alone must, you know, make you a fortune.
Well, I don't know about fortune, but it does all right.
Yeah.
It's actually not been a giant disaster that I thought it was going into. It's been fun.
Still a lot of work to write and research and write a book. A lot of work.
Of course. No. You have to deal with people who are alive. Alive is troublesome. Lots of documents, I'm sure. How long did you say it took? 3 years?
3 years, which is about 50% longer than it's taken me to write my other books, because this was such a complicated story. Right from the get-go, this was a complicated, complex company to write about.
Well, I can imagine. And look, I love the Bear Stearns book.
Thank you.
What's it called?
House of Cards.
House of Cards.
The Bear Stearns.
Yeah, that book was amazing. Well, it was great to chat, and thanks for coming up. And
great to chat. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks so much for listening. If you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it, and I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.